This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
Hebrews it is for just a little while longer, and we're sort of on a roll here talking about the things that the writer of Hebrews does like so much to talk about. And we will talk about more of them. And a passage here this morning is a little longer than usual and, frankly, a little more challenging than usual. But as they like to say, we ain't scared. Right? We're not afraid. We just dive. We dive right in, because unlike those idiots who dive into places they don't know how deep it is, we're all right here. Go ahead and dive, because I've already told you this is deep. You don't have to worry. This is not shallow. So dive. All right? So just do it. If you learn how to dive, that is. Well, look with me then. At the end of chapter 3, just moving right into chapter 4. Yeah, we're going to violate the law of do not ever cross over a chapter line. But as I've said so many times, I pay no heed to the chapter markers because some 16th century guys put those in. They're helpful. But to me, I just keep on going. So let's pick it up here and read some Hebrews. It's a little longer than usual, so I got a few slides worth, but hang with it, all right? So right here, starting in verse 16 of chapter 3. For who were those who heard and yet rebelled? Was it not all those who left Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he provoked for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were unable to enter because of unbelief. Therefore, while the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should seem to have failed to reach it. For good news came to us just as to them. But the message they heard did not benefit them, because they were not united by faith with those who listened. For we who have believed enter that rest. As he said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Although his works were finished from the foundation of the world, for he has somewhere spoken of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this passage he said, and this one he's just citing, they said, they shall not enter my rest. Since therefore it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly received the good news fail to enter because of disobedience, again he appoints a certain day, today, saying through David so long afterward, in the words already quoted, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his. Let us therefore strive to enter that rest, so that no one may fall by the same sort of disobedience. For the word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and spirit, of joints and of marrow, and discerning the thoughts and intentions of the heart. And no creature is hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. The word of God. And what a word. Now, it's long and, yeah, boy, that one's kind of tough. But you sensed a theme, maybe. Maybe you sensed a kind of theme in what is a, admittedly, difficult passage. I mean, a lot of people admit this. It's not the easiest theme here to understand and to wrap your mind completely around. And of course, like a lot of things, you know, it's tempting. Oh, so tempting to, on that account, just ignore it. I mean, just to say, that one's kind of hard. So, moving on, just tearing the page. And, you know, I might be easily tempted to do that. And why should I stand up here and talk about all these all this theological stuff in this passage is kind of difficult, when in fact I could just mosey on through to the next part of Hebrews. The problem is, sometimes there's something that's not just a one-off, odd passage that's difficult, and we kind of can just file it away as, put an asterisk by it. It's different. The fact is, though, in something like this, it's too important. I can't do it. I'm not allowed to, in part because this concept, while a little bit tough to wrestle with, it's too important. It sort of spans the scripture. I mean, it's pretty obvious here that this writer thinks it's important. I mean, we just heard that passage. He's hammering and hammering and hammering. So he doesn't want to let you off the hook. He wants you to sort of come to some understanding of what he's trying to say. Hence all the warnings. Fear lest you didn't strive to enter. Don't be like those. I mean, stuff with that much warning language in it, you probably don't want to too lightly just brush it aside and move on. I need to know what warnings mean, right? You do that with warnings. I mean, now some of you guys are, you're kind of stupid. You see warnings in all caps in red, and you just kind of go, yeah, whatever. Warning, do not put this product in, blah, blah, blah. Let's just do this already. You know? Well, you probably ought to read warnings. I mean, sometimes they're dumb, and they're there for legal reasons because lawyers force them to put warnings that really are kind of silly, you know? Like I talked about diving into shallow water. But you know, sometimes when you buy, sometimes they install pools, they put signs like, do not dive into pool without water. Or, you know, things like that. And you think, what do they take me for? Why'd they do that? Well, some lawyer somewhere sued a pool maker one time because they failed to put a sign warning someone that they shouldn't dive in when there's no water. So, you know, we want to cover our bases. But usually, or very often, warnings are not like that. They're not dumb and superfluous. They might matter. You might want to read them. And so this passage has warnings, so I just can't ignore it. Not only that, this business of rest, is it important? It's important enough to be. It's very old. So it's not a new thing. He didn't just introduce it. How old is the concept of rest? Well, he quoted something that's pretty old. Goes back, I don't know, to the creation account. I mean, that's going back a ways. So if it's that old, if right out of the gate there is some importance about this idea of rest, well, I probably ought to take it seriously enough to consider it and try to understand it. Not only that, but you know, there is actually one of the Ten Commandments. Are the Ten Commandments pretty central, pretty important? Yeah. This is the Big Ten we're talking about here. And one of them actually commands people to take a rest. And so all those reasons mean, no matter how much we might like to say, this is a little bit challenging and hard to understand, so let's just move on. We shall not do it. We'll look at it. We'll consider it. We'll think through it. It's not just mentioned in passing. So let's consider then here some of the different ideas of rest, this theme, different times we encounter throughout the written word, times we encounter this concept of rest that are mentioned even just in this passage. This writer mentions all these four I show you here. And so, as I said, we start with the first one, the original rest of creation, which he quotes here in the passage we just read. Now, I'm going to set aside the old debate and recurring debate of how we interpret the creation account. Do we take it literally or not? It's a worthwhile debate, but it's not our main focus here. We could get lost in those weeds real fast and forget about the whole thing. I'm really mentioning this bullet point here, that in the creation, however you take it, there it was important enough to mention that one of the days is just committed to rest. And I don't know about you, but it didn't take me long as a kid, okay, in church and in Sunday school. It didn't take me long as a kid to pause and wonder when I was hearing about how, and on the seventh day, God rested from his work. I don't think it's sacrilege to wonder something quite obvious, especially when you're just coming onto it. You know, honest questions are not to be thrown out. You shouldn't shame churchgoers, especially kids, for asking honest questions. And so as a child, my logical mind pondered the seventh day and said, and I thought to myself, does God get tired I mean, I've been learning stuff about God for a while in church, and if I understand correctly, God is not the sort of being who tires. I've heard that, you know, he sleeps not, nor does he slumber. First of all, I've learned that he's not even a physical being, so surely he doesn't experience physical fatigue. But even mentally, he doesn't just have one of those days, you know. It's just not the way God is. And so what can it mean if it, you know, if right in the very beginning we have this idea that he rests, so we know what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean, well, he just got all tuckered out. Creating universes is hard work. So he got winded, you know. Sort of like had to stop, and you see him over there with his hands on his knees, just, whew, yeah, man, really wore me out, all this creating. No, that's not how that goes. That can't be so. That's not God. And he didn't get just worn out and wearied. Oh, there must be something deeper here. There must be something more of a more theological nature we're supposed to understand about God resting. And of course, one of the things we come, among other things, and I can't belabor too much, one of the things for sure is that there is certainly an example being set. That if nothing else, there is a pattern or an example from the beginning that then gets echoed later when the command is given. But before we get to the command, let's talk about another one of these, of the prominent mentions of rest in the Scripture that we get in this passage. And that comes from the long and arduous period in which the freed people just wandered around out in the middle of nowhere for all those years. Weary. Now, sometimes we read about all that wandering, and it's a well-known story, and we could easily fail to appreciate just what a challenging life it would be if you lived in that time. Is it better than living under the iron rule of an empire like that of the Pharaoh and being enslaved like they were? Well, it's got to be better than that. But you know, sometimes the immediate freeing of a people does not, you know, just translate to quick and easy paradise. Even in American history, there was a time when a lot of people were freed, but the years following immediately after were not always just great. Right? Just read your history. It's called Reconstruction and all that stuff. And things take a while to sort of get better. Now that's a very distant sort of analogy, but just the principle alone. The people of Israel did not march out of there, no longer slaves, lead on Moses, and march about, you know, 30 to 40 yards through a set of pearly gates into their own personal paradise. Wouldn't that have been a great story? Just sort of like a neighboring kingdom, just follow me, guys. Just, you know, maybe a half a day's travel. Didn't go like that. They found themselves out in the middle of nowhere, and they looked ahead to something. And of course, you know, people quote the Bible, as I say all the time, more than they realize, and people are familiar with the idea of a promised land. Even people who know nothing about the Scriptures talk about the promised land. It's become proverbial for us. The idea of a promised land, right? The idea of a promised land is a good thing, isn't it? It's a positive thing. It's an optimistic thing. I'm going to the promised land. It's a good place. It's a place you want to get to. You're striving to get there, but it's hard to get to, and it takes a while to get to it, but it's going to be great when you get there. By the way, the place they were going, that place they were going, now it's described as a nice place. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. Presumably it's fertile, a place you can grow places and settle, grow a lot of crops, and you know, and you can have herds and flocks, and you can live. But I mean, it wasn't supernaturally great. The place they were going, this land, Canaan, it's good land, but it's not like donuts grew out of the ground for them, and they rode sparkly unicorns with wings. I mean, you know, and there was a fountain of youth. It wasn't like that. It was just regular land. I mean, it was better than average. It wasn't just a barren, terrible wasteland. You know? It was fertile enough. But it's like, look, if you know, it's like all those Western pioneers once upon a time that went out to, you know, a homestead. I mean, they got to a place and said, wow, this is great. We'll live here. This is fantastic. But, you know, it was just Nebraska. So what was so great about it? I mean, it was just, it's like that great line in Field of Dreams, right? And when the ghost of Shoeless Joe, he says, is this heaven? And what does Costner say?
It's Iowa.
No, this is Iowa, you know. But hey, to some people, Iowa's pretty good heaven. Why? You got good soil. You got good rainfall. It ain't so bad. The people were trying to get somewhere. But here's the deal. So what makes it their rest? Why were they trying to get to their rest? What made it so fantastic a place? Because when you have no home, and when you're out in the middle of nowhere, you know what you have that's hard to live day to day with? You have uncertainty. You have high anxiety. You have insecurity. You have dangers. The danger that if we get too far out away from supplies, we don't know what it's like to travel with massive groups of people. But, you know, you ever watch the news and hear about how there are displaced people? This happens today sometimes. You ever see how there are people that are displaced out? People that are nomads. They've been removed from their home. They're called refugees sometimes. And how's that life? What's life like? Even today, even now in the modern world with all of our wonderful amenities, you do not want to find yourself among a massive herd of refugees. It's no way to live. Right? Because it's... you need stuff to live. We take for granted. But even during periods, you know, when you read back about periods of history, like the Civil War, they would get, you know, one of their biggest fears was that they would march an army that out too far from supply lines. You get yourself cut off, you're not going to last long. You got to have water to drink. You have to have food to feed everyone. So imagine Israel. They're way out. They don't even know where. And all they know is, every day we go that way, we're further away from that way. And what's that way? I don't know. I know now we're so far from the sources that we had for water and food that it's like we've reached the point of no return. And where are you then? You're way out on a wing and a prayer, my friend. You're completely relying on God. And as much as it's a wonderful concept to completely lean on the everlasting arms, it's easier sung about than done. Because when God's all you got left, that's a very Christian way to live. And you ought to strive to have the kind of faith where you could live that life. But let's be honest with each other. You don't really, every part of you wants a security. You want to say, I rely on you, Lord. But I really need a nest egg. And I got to have a house. And I need my property. And I need a clean bill of health. I mean, in other words, I'm leaning on you, Lord, but I really want all the stuff that gives me the security that I want and need. The people were no different. They found themselves out in the middle of nowhere when that all they had is, man, I hope manna shows up tomorrow. It doesn't taste good, but it keeps us alive. And if one morning it's not there, we're doomed. All right? If those cornflakes don't turn up on the ground tomorrow, whatever that stuff was, you know what the word manna meant in Hebrew? What is it? Manna. What is it? I don't know. Eat it, though. You will eat every bite of your manna and you will like it. I don't like manna. You eat it. Yeah, you're relying completely. So, you see why now? When you're in that much danger and you don't know where the food's coming from, not to mention that, I mean, it's a tough world and you're subject to whatever army encounters you out there. They were not an army. They're just a bunch of people, women and children and the whole bit. So if they come across enemies, they're finished. They're just going to be enslaved by the next empire they come across. They escaped one, and maybe the next one will be even harsher than the Egyptians. You don't understand what it's like to live every day with complete anxiety? Some of you do. Some of you do. How fun is it to wake up every day just worried sick about stuff? And yet, a lot of life can be like that. The promised land, among many other things for the people, was the place where we can go, we're here. We can build here. We got water here. We can grow food here. We can build walls around this place. I can sleep at night for the first time without my mind just in a pretzel of anxiety. So, rest. But some people, of course, as we read in this passage and we're reminded, some people got sick and tired of waiting and worrying. What can anxiety do to you? What can your worry do to you? It can mess you up. It can make you really, I'll put it in mild terms. It can make you irritable. Right? And so a bunch of people rebelled. We're sick of this. We want to go back. So there were some people never got to see it. Okay. Well, there's the weekly Sabbath. That's another prominent mention of rest. Odd, isn't it, that among the right in there with the biggies, do not kill, do not steal from each other, right in there with the big ones, is I got to keep the Sabbath holy? That seems kind of like a lightweight commandment. I mean, compared to don't murder people. Seems, and yet somehow, there you go. You're supposed to observe the Sabbath. But to what degree? Well, I mean, at least to some degree it's in there. Even though, as I know you know, Jesus later was confronted by the keepers, the gatekeepers of the law, and they said, you and your guys are Sabbath breakers. And he said to them, Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Lighten up, boys. But yet, here it is as a command. So, and Jews today still practice, you know, sundown on Friday, right? The future rest, the last one here, is the final and ultimate rest. We're reminded of that. This passage I told you, it makes mention of all four of these. So there's a final rest. He says there still remains a rest for the people of God. There still remains a rest. So let's summarize, as best we can, let's summarize how this writer weaves these together. I'll give it to you like this. I had to write this one down to try to keep it clear. If we summarize what he's saying, it might be put something like this. The promise of an ultimate rest still stands. The rest that was once promised to Israel, the people, via Moses, was finally delivered through Joshua. Some people didn't get it. They were judged. They didn't get to enter it. But even that rest they entered finally through Joshua was not the ultimate one. You know, the writer says, hey, if that was the ultimate one, we wouldn't still have a promise. But we, like they, must strive to enter this rest and be very worried lest you would fail to enter it. See, he's continuing this kind of perseverance theme. Remember we talked about last week? This still kind of has to do with persevering. We do not want to fail to enter it through disobedience like the rebels of Israel. Well, let's take a minute though and just get kind of practical about this. There's a lot of theology here, but what about day-to-day life? You know, I'm talking about anxiety and worry. I don't know how to compare people from different ages. Every era and every age the people have different things they worry about primarily. You, for example, don't worry very much about, I don't know, polio, the diseases that have largely been eradicated don't worry you very much like they worried other people. But you got different worries. You got different concerns that tend to plague us. Is it important? Can that wreck your life? Is that something you have to deal with? Just to get down to regular old health, sleep and rest. I mean, there's the minor physical benefits and there are the major things. How do you think people sleep today? Think they sleep pretty well today? I mean, hey, we live in the modern world. We got the advantages that no one ever had. Think about all the generations that came before us. They didn't have the kind of beds that we have, the They didn't have all the comforts. You can set your thermostat to the exact degree temperature that you sleep best in. But just imagine people who just had to sort of sleep in whatever it was, they had to figure out how to sleep in it. You know? They couldn't do it. We have entire industries dedicated to sleep health. You ever hear all those commercials about sleep health? There are clinics. There are professionals whose full-time job is dedicated to helping people sleep better. You can buy your own individualized mattress. A mattress made just for you. I don't know what they do. Take all your vitals and information and DNA. I don't know what they do to figure out a personalized mattress. Memory foam. You can even get your own individual pillow. You heard these companies? My Pillow. What, no one else can use this thing? It's matched up just to me. It's oh, that only works for my head. You can't use it. No, it's adjusted to me. Man, I remember the good old days when pillows were just kind of generic. You know, all of them were sort of the same. We got everything you would want. And so surely we sleep far better than all the people who ever went before us with all these benefits. We must sleep much better than they ever did. Isn't that true? Not so much. All this we have, all this, and yet people, if you know, both anecdotally, just the people you know, and statistically, we find out that people are lousy sleepers today. Every other person I talk to today says, I can't sleep worth the darn. I can't get any sleep last night. I have a hard time, so I have trouble sleeping. This is just normal. I'm always like, don't you have a comfortable bed? I'm not trying to be insensitive. I'm curious. What? And of course, I know many of the things that can... Now, sometimes there are genuine physical ailments. People have back problems and so on. But you know what causes a whole lot of us to not sleep well? It's not physical. Statistics say that a lot of young people... And I'm talking... Now, young people don't have all our back trouble just yet. All right? Arthritis, whatever it is. Hey man, when you're young, you don't deal with that stuff yet. And yet, a lot of them report that they don't sleep. I've read this stuff from the APA, you know, the American Psychological Association, and something called the ADAA, which is the Association for Depression and Anxiety in America. I think that's what that is. And they do all these statistics, and you know, they say that people today are not sleeping as much as they did, and are not sleeping well. And they say that one of the leading reasons for this is simple. It's stress. It's people's anxieties. Their minds are turning over. They have so many relationships that are sour, that worry them and concern them, and they think about, and there's a sort of self-focus. Am I happy? Am I doing well? Do people like me? You know? Their online presence, what do people think of me? Are you laying awake at night worrying about how many likes you got? Really? What does this tell us? What do we learn? And here's the thing. The more concerns and worries you have, that will catch up with you. It catches up with your health, and one of the ways is sleep and rest. So there's a direct bearing. I'm sort of showing how this ancient concept of people, of genuine, really genuine rest, good, solid, quality rest that goes beyond just the physical, but it's spiritual in nature. You know what I mean? It's the whole person that is very relevant right now. Well, one of the writers who was almost as good a writer as myself, is... And I sometimes quote him, who captured this very well, is the Bard. Who am I talking about? I'm talking about my man, Willie. Well, he liked to write about kings. He's fascinated by kings. In the ancient world, it was a king who had all the burden and anxiety, had all the trouble of everything, all the responsibility. You see, with great privilege, right? You want to be the man... Right? You got to live with all of the burdens of the man. So a king lives in all of the great pomp And you know, the difference in haves and have-nots was very, very wide. The gulf was wide. You know, between he who lives in a palace and owns everything, and everyone else, the most of the peasants who owned almost nothing. You know? Wouldn't it be great to be a king? It's good to be king. But the king also has anxieties. And so this is a really interesting, the way that Shakespeare captures the idea that being a king and having all this greatness and having all this privilege, talk about checking your privilege. I mean, the king really needs to check his privilege. He's got it all. And yet, there's something he can't get. So one of his kings, Henry IV, has trouble. There's something that his money won't buy him. There's something that his power, he can't wave his scepter and command it. And that is, he can't get genuine rest because he's got wars going on and he's got all these things and he's got people trying to usurp his throne and all this. And so listen to what this passage, this little passage where he's talking to himself, he's sort of talking to the audience. He's sort of thinking out loud, Henry IV, talking about one night when he can't sleep. And so he says this. He says, "How many thousands of my poorest subjects are at this hour asleep? Oh, gentle sleep, nature's soft nurse, how have I frighted thee that thou wilt no more weigh my eyelids down and steep my senses in forgetfulness? Why, rather, sleep, liest thou in smoky cribs upon uneasy pallets than in the perfumed chambers of the great and under the canopies of costly state? O thou dull god, why liest thou with the vile in loathsome beds and leavest the kingly couch? Wilt thou upon the high and giddy mast seal up the shipboy's eyes and rock his brains in the cradle of the rude imperious surge? Canst thou, O sleep, give thy repose to the wet sea boy in an hour so rude? And yet in the calmest and most stillest night, with all appliances and means to boot, deny it to a king. Then, happy low lie down, uneasy lies the head that wears a crown." It's a famous line there. Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. There he is. Because you see, however your life is lived, responsibility, trouble, anxiety, things to worry you, add those up. And to that extent, you cannot get real and genuine rest. The spiritual application in the most ultimate sense is this. As this writer says, we are challenged to strive to enter a rest. There is one of the benefits that comes with the salvation that we dare not neglect. One of the many, many benefits is something as simple as this. One of the greatest quotes ever is from St. Augustine. He wrote the Confessions, which are basically prayers. And look at how he words this. This is one to remember. This is one to write down. This is good. One of his prayers, it's a very short little section, it's a pretty famous line. He says, "You," speaking to God, "you have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it rests in you." We have restless hearts. That is a perfect word. What does it mean for a person to be restless? A restless person can't quite find what he wants and what he needs. She can't just relax and be calm. Restless. There's something undone, uncertain. I got too many anxieties. I can't think straight. I can't relax. I can't even enjoy anything. I'm too restless about things. That is one of the conditions of fallen man. Our weakness, our propensity, among so many other propensities, to just be restless. worried about everything. How can I just lay these burdens down? You know, Moses, as the writer says here, Moses representing the law, can show the way out of the wilderness. The law can point you toward the rest. It can point you. The problem is the law can't deliver. The law can't lead you there. It was Joshua. It was Yeshua. Not that Yeshua in the sound booth. It was Yeshua, Joshua. See where I'm going here? Who led them into that rest? The law can point the way. The law holds up and shows us the pattern. It shows you the way. The law will not get you there. You need Yeshua. He will lead you into that place. He who said, Matthew 11:28, "Come to me," he said, "all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you" what? Rest.
Whatever things are lovely, whatever things are true, whatever things are of good report, if they're being heard, you know, let us think upon these things. Let God be true and every man a liar. And that is what it comes down to.